Chapter 12. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Opium and Tobacco. Few plants can lay claim to such complex and tangled relationships to human beings as can the opium poppy and the tobacco plant. Both plants are central to extremely addictive behaviors in human beings that shorten life and burden society with medical and financial consequences, yet the general attitude toward these plants could hardly be more different. Opium is illegal throughout most of the world. The poppy-growing areas that are the source of raw opium are closely monitored by photosurveillance satellites, and yearly advanced projections of world opium production are closely studied by governments to aid them in calculating how much of their budgets to allocate to treatment of addicts, foreign eradication efforts, and domestic interdiction of refined opium products like morphine and heroin. Tobacco, on the other hand, is probably the most widely consumed plant drug on Earth. No nation has ever decreed smoking of tobacco illegal, and indeed, any country that sought to do so would find itself at loggerheads with one of the most powerful international narcotic cartels ever to exist. Yet there is no dispute that tobacco smoking is the cause of early death for millions of people. Lung cancer, emphysema, and heart disease have all been linked to smoking. And tobacco is no less addicting than the supposed hardest of hard drugs, heroin. When this fact was stated by U.S. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, it was quickly buried in the storm of derision unleashed by the major American tobacco companies and their legions of addicted customers. Paradoxical attitudes. What can we learn from the comparison of these two plants? Both have a long history of human usage, both are addictive and ultimately destructive, and yet one is firmly integrated into our lifestyles and sold to us as masculine, sophisticated, pleasurable, while the other is illegal, furiously suppressed, inveighed against as suicidal, and viewed with an unreflecting horror that earlier generations reserved for Bolsheviks, suffragettes, and oral sex. This situation is but another example of the hypocrisy of dominator culture as it picks and chooses the truths and realities that it finds comfortable. The fact is that while heroin is highly addictive, and while one of its preferred routes of ingestion, intravenous self-injection, offers opportunities for the spread of serious disease, it is nevertheless no more dangerous than its legal and highly touted competitor, tobacco. Volumes of scientific research have concluded that no known organic damage is caused by the use of heroin. It is a physically benign, though powerfully addicting, substance. The differences in the way that society views these two now globally pandemic plant-based drugs cannot be the result of a reasonable assessment of their deleterious social impacts. If it were, then attitudes toward these two plants would be similar. As it is, we must look at effects unrelated to the shared property of addiction to understand why dominator society has chosen to suppress one and exalt the other. Smoking introduced to Europe. Tobacco is native to the New World, and so is the custom of smoking plant material to obtain narcotic effects from it. Smoking may have been known in the Old World during the Neolithic period. Scholarly opinion differs. However, there is no evidence of tobacco smoking being a practice known to any of the historical civilizations of the Old World until Columbus introduced it following his second voyage to the Americas. Less than 100 years later, small packets of tobacco were being placed into the graves of Lapland shamans. This gives some notion of how quickly tobacco was able to assert its traditional pattern of usage, even in a society that was completely unfamiliar with it. Tobacco, chewed, snuffed, and smoked, has been with us ever since. By the 19th century, tobacco use had been culturally classified in Europe as a man's prerogative. Successful men were judged by the quantity and quality of cigars they smoked. And tobacco was added to the long list of male dominator privileges, which included nearly all alcohol, brandies for the ladies, please, control of finance, access to prostitutes, and control of political power. Recall those smoke-filled rooms. Even in today's drug-conscious atmosphere, no contradiction is perceived between the strident calls to eliminate the use of drugs in professional athletics and the figure of the tobacco-chewing major league pitcher, eyes hardened with narcotic intensity as he strides to the mound. Does the elimination of drugs from competitive sports mean the extinction of that lovable figure, the lump-cheeked hayseed with a good pitching arm? Somehow I doubt it. As tobacco was achieving its present stature, opium, too, was enjoying a vogue, albeit nothing on the scale of tobacco. Laudanum, tincture of opium and alcohol, was being used as a cure for colic in infants, a woman's tonic, a cure for dysentery, and most significantly by writers, travelers, and other bohemian types as a stimulant of the creative imagination. Morphine, which must be injected, was the first alkaloid to be isolated. This event in 1805 cast a dark shadow over the halcyon world of the laudanum enthusiast, for however much artistic mileage Coleridge and De Quincey obtained from their imagined enslavement to the fiend of opium, their addictions, though serious, when judged in the light of modern experience with cocaine freebase and new synthetic forms of heroin, appear almost minor. The ancient lure of opium. The seed of the poppy is a delicious and non-psychoactive food, as all enthusiasts of poppy seed rolls can attest. Yet when the seed capsule is scratched with blade or fingernail, a milky latex-like material soon accumulates and, as it hardens, turns a dark brown. This material is raw opium, like the psilocybin mushroom with its association with cattle and the parasitism of ergot on rye and other cereals. The opium poppy is a major psychoactive plant that has evolved in the presence of a human food source. In the case of the opium poppy, Papaver somniferum, the psychoactivity and the nutritional value are sectioned off into different parts of the same plant. Opium in various forms has been in the physician's armamentarium since at least 1600 BC. An Egyptian medical treatise of that period prescribed opium for crying children, just as Victorian nannies dosed infants with opiate-laced Godfrey's cordial to keep them quiet. For most of its history, opium was not smoked, but rather the black sticky resin was dissolved into wine and drunk, or else rolled into a pellet and swallowed. Opium as a cure for pain, as euphorant and rumored aphrodisiac, was known in Eurasia for several thousand years. During the waning of the millennia-long Minoan civilization and its religion of archaic worship of a great mother, the original source of the connection to the goddess of vegetable nature came eventually to be replaced by the intoxication of opium. Early Minoan texts testify to the fact that poppies were widely cultivated on both Crete and Pylos during the late Minoan. In these texts, the poppy head is used as an ideogram in financial tallies. The yield of poppies indicated is so huge that for some time it was assumed that these numbers must refer to grain rather than opium. The confusion of grain and poppy is easy to understand, as Demeter was the goddess of both. In fact, how much of the lore of the poppy was transferred to the Greek mysteries of Demeter on the mainland remains to be elucidated, especially as there is some iconographic confusion between the poppy flower and the pomegranate, also a plant associated with the mysteries. Kereni quotes Theocritus 7:157. For the Greeks, Demeter was still a poppy goddess, bearing sheaves and poppies in both hands. A remarkable illustration in Eric Newman's The Great Mother shows the goddess in association with a beehive and holding poppy seed capsules and heads of grain in her left hand, while resting her right hand on one of the unadorned pillars to the central Minoan earth religion. Rarely have so many elements of the archaic technology of ecstasy been brought together so explicitly. The figure is almost an allegory of the transformation of Minoan shamanic spirituality in its late phase. Its mushroom roots are symbolized in the aniconic column. They are the touchstone of the goddess who looks toward the promise of poppies and ergotized grain. The hive of bees introduces the theme of honey, the archetypal image of ecstasy, female sexuality, and preservation that survives the shifting botanical identities of the sacraments. Poppies and gum opium were known to the ancient Egyptians and appear in their funeral arts as well as in the earliest medical papyruses. Poppies were known in several varieties to the Persians. In ancient Greece and elsewhere, the poppy was known as the destroyer of grief. Theophrastus knew of it as a sleep-inducing drug in 300 BC, and his observations were repeated by Pliny in the 1st century AD with added thoughts on opium poisoning. The Greeks consecrated the poppy to Nyx, goddess of night, Morpheus, son of Hypnos and god of dreams, and Thanatos, god of death. They summarized all of its properties in the deities to whom it was offered. Opium spread throughout the Islamic world after the 7th century. It was undoubtedly used both as a dysentery cure and for those overburdened with grief and care. Although opium's habit-forming quality was mentioned by Heraclides of Tarentum in the 3rd century BC, this was something even physicians were generally unaware of until nearly 2,000 years later. We who have been raised with the notion of addiction as disease may find it hard to believe that chemical dependency upon opiates was not noted or described by medical authorities until early in the 17th century. Samuel Purchas, writing in 1613, observed of opium that But being once used, it must daily be continued on pain of death, though some escape by taking to wine instead. Alethea Hayter comments that this awareness that opium is addictive is rarely found so early. For the ancient world, then, opium was that which brought sleep and relief from pain. Opium was prescribed and perhaps overprescribed during the final days of the Roman Empire. Then the use of opium nearly ceased for many centuries in Europe. The early herbals of Saxon England mentioned juice expelled from poppies as a cure for headache and sleeplessness, but clearly opium played a very minor role in the armamentarium of medieval Europe. Martin Roulin's Alchemical Lexicon, published in 1612, mentions only the word osorer as a synonym for opium, and then without explanation. Alchemical Opium. It is to Paracelsus, the famed father of chemotherapy, that we can trace the revival of interest in opium. The great 16th-century Swiss alchemist, medical reformer, and quack advocated and used opium on a lavish scale. Here again, as in the case of distilled alcohol, it is an alchemist, one involved in the pursuit of the spirit assumed to be locked into matter, who discovered the means to release the power locked within a simple plant. And like Lully before him, Paracelsus assumed that he had discovered the universal panacea. I possess a secret remedy which I call laudanum, and which is superior to all other heroic remedies. Shortly after Paracelsus began promulgating the virtues of opium, physicians of his school of thought were preparing nostrums whose sole basis of activity was the copious amount of opium that they contained. One of these enthusiastic followers, the alchemist Van Helmont, became well known as Dr. Opiates, the first croaker or junk doctor. Tobacco Redux. While the iatrochemists of the Paracelsian persuasion were spreading the use of opium in Europe, an exotic newcomer was quietly making its way onto the European stage. Tobacco was the first and most immediate payoff of the discovery of the New World. On November 2, 1492, less than a month after his first arrival in the New World, Columbus landed on the north coast of Cuba. There, the Admiral of the Ocean Sea dispatched two gift-laden members of his crew to the interior of the island, where he believed that the king of the many coastal villages he had seen must reside. Doubtless, there was still some hope in the admiral's mind that his men would return with word of gold, precious stones, fine woods and spices, the wealth of the Indies. Instead, the scouts returned with an account of men and women who partially inserted burning rolls of leaves into their nostrils. These burning rolls were called tobaccos and consisted of dry herbs wrapped up in a large dry leaf. They were lit at one end, and the people sucked at the other and drank the smoke, or inhaled, something that was utterly unknown in Europe. De las Casas, the bishop of Chiapas, who published the account of Columbus's in which this description occurs, added this observation: "I know of Spaniards who imitate this custom, and when I reprimand the savage practice, they answered that it was not in their power to refrain from indulging in the habit, although the Spaniards were extremely surprised by this peculiar custom. On experimenting with it themselves, they soon obtained such pleasure that they began to imitate the savage example." 4 years after the first voyage, the hermit Romano Pani, whom Columbus had left in Haiti at the conclusion of the second voyage to the New World, described in his journal the native habit of inhaling the tobacco fumes with the help of a birdbone instrument inserted into the nose and held over tobacco strewn on a bed of coals. The consequences of this simple ethnograph observation have still to be calculated. It introduced into Europe an extremely efficient method for conveying drugs, including many potentially dangerous drugs, into the human body. It made possible the worldwide pandemic of tobacco smoking. It was a fast-acting and easily abused route of administering both opium and hashish, and it was the distant ancestor of the crack cocaine and PCP smoker. It also, it must be said, makes possible the most profound of the indole-hallucinogen-induced ecstasies, the rarely encountered but incomparable practice of smoking dimethyltryptamine. Shamanic tobaccos. Tobacco smoking was widespread in North America at the time of the European contact. While the habit of taking hallucinogenic DMT-containing snuffs was also prevalent in the Caribbean cultural area, there are no confirmed reports of materials other than tobacco being smoked. The high culture of the Maya that flourished until the mid-800s in Mesoamerica had an old and complex relationship with tobacco and the habit of smoking it. The tobacco of the classical Maya was Nicotiana rustica, which is still in use among Aboriginal populations in South America today. This species is much more potent, chemically complex, and potentially hallucinogenic than the commercial grades of Nicotiana tobacum available today. The difference between this tobacco and cigarette tobacco is profound. This wild tobacco was cured and rolled into cigars, which were smoked. The trance-like state that followed, partially synergized by the presence of compounds that included MAO inhibitors, was central to the shamanism of the Maya. Recently introduced antidepressants of the MAO inhibitor type are distant synthetic relatives of these natural compounds. Francis Robisek has published extensively on the Mayan fascination with tobacco and its chemical complexity. It also must be recognized that nicotine is by no means the only bioactive substance in the tobacco leaf. Recently, alkaloids of the Harmala group, Harman and Non-Harman, have been isolated from cured commercial tobaccos and their smoke. They constitute a chemical group of beta-carbolines, which include harmine, harmaline, tetrahydroharmine, and 6-methoxyharmine, all with hallucinogenic properties. While to date no native varieties of tobacco have been analyzed for these substances, it is a reasonable supposition that their composition may vary widely, depending upon the variety and growth, and that some of the native-grown tobaccos may contain a relatively high concentration of them. Tobacco was and is the ever-present adjunct of the more powerful and visionary hallucinogenic plants wherever in the Americas they are used in a traditional and shamanic way. And one of the traditional uses of tobacco involved the New World's invention of the first enemas. Peter First had researched the role of enemas and clysters in Mesoamerican medicine and shamanism. It has only recently come to light that the ancient Maya, like the ancient Peruvians, employed enemas. Enema syringes or narcotic clysters, and even enema rituals, were discovered to be represented in Maya art, an outstanding example being a large painted vase dating AD 600 to 800, on which a man is depicted carrying an enema syringe, applying an enema to himself, and having a woman apply it to him. As a result of this newly discovered scene, archaeologist M.D. Coe was able to identify a curious object held by a jaguar deity on another painted Maya vessel as an enema syringe. If the enemas of the ancient Maya were, like those of the Peruvian Indians, intoxicating or hallucinogenic, they might have consisted of fermented balche, honey mead. B&W is a very sacred beverage, and it may have been fortified with tobacco or with morning glory seed infusions. Datura infusions and even hallucinogenic mushrooms may have been taken in this way. Of course, they could also have used a tobacco infusion alone. Tobacco as quack medicine. Any drug introduced into use inevitably winds up associated with a number of quack medical theories and treatments. Cocaine abuse, as we shall see, was preceded by the craze for the tonic Vinde Mariani, and heroin was touted as a cure for morphine addiction. Lest we recoil from the enema rituals of the Maya, consider that in 1661, the Danish physician Thomas Bartholin recommended not only tobacco juice enemas, but also tobacco smoke enemas to his patients. Those who have swallowed tobacco by accident can testify to its purgative effect. This property is employed in the tobacco clyster used as an enema. My beloved brother Erasmus has shown me the method. Smoke from 2 pipes filled with tobacco is blown into the intestines. A suitable instrument for this was devised by the ingenious English. Not to be outdone by the clever English, an 18th-century French physician named Boucauz advocated the use of intravaginal insufflation of tobacco smoke to cure hysteria. Quite aside from these eccentric and bizarre applications of the use of tobacco, and despite the scorn of the clergy, the habit of smoking spread quickly in Europe. Every drug, during the process of its introduction into a new cultural milieu, is hailed as a love drug, this apparently being the most effective of all advertising ploys. Drugs as diverse as heroin and cocaine, LSD and MDMA, were all at some point presented as promoting intimacy, sexual or psychological. Tobacco was no different. Part of the reason for its rapid spread was widely circulated sailors' yarns of its remarkable properties as an aphrodisiac. Sailors told of the women of Nicaragua who smoked this weed and displayed an ardor undreamed of. It was probably this rumor that clinched the popularity of smoking among the women of Europe. Perhaps this is the reason why an ex-Franciscan monk, André Thévet, experienced such success in introducing tobacco to the French court in 1579. Thévet fully intended that tobacco be smoked and used as a recreational drug. Earlier, the French ambassador to Portugal, Jean Nicot, had experimented with crushed tobacco leaves used as a snuff for the purpose of curing migraine headache. In 1560, Nicot conveyed a sample of his snuff to Catherine de' Medici, who was a chronic migraine sufferer. The queen was enthusiastic about the plant's powers, and it briefly became known as Herba Medicia, or Herba Catharinea. Nicot's snuff was derived from the generally more toxic Nicotiana rustica, the classic shamanic tobacco of the Maya. The vase Nicotiana tobacum conquered Europe in the form of the cigarette, and was the plant that became the basis for the tremendously important tobacco economy that grew up in the colonial New World. Contra tobacco. Tobacco was not welcomed by all. Pope Urban VIII ordered excommunication for anyone who smoked or used snuff in the churches of Spain. In 1650, Innocent X forbade snuff-taking in the Basilica of St. Peter on pain of excommunication. Protestants also decried the new habit and were led in their effort by no less than King James I of England, whose inflammatory Counterblast to Tobacco appeared in 1604. And now, good countrymen, let us, I pray you, consider what honor or policy can move us to imitate the slavish Indians, especially in so vile and stinking custom. I say without blushing, why do we abase ourselves so far as to imitate these beastly Indians, slaves to the Spaniards, refuse to the world, and as yet aliens to the holy covenant of God? Why do we not as well imitate them in walking naked as they do? Yes, why do we not deny God and adore the devil as they do? Having unleashed this rhetorical counterblast, in what may be seen as the first unlimbering of the just-say-no approach, the king turned his attention to other matters. 8 years later, a report claimed that in the city of London alone, there were no fewer than 7,000 tobacconists and tobacco houses. Tobacco smoking and snuff-taking were pursued at the level of intensity of a modern craze. Tobacco triumphant. In commercial terms, tobacco did not attain major importance until after the close of the Thirty Years' War in 1648. By then, American colonies were in place and well able to participate in the mercantile economy that had been established. In fact, this economy ran in large part on the tobacco of the North American colonies and the distilled alcohol and raw sugar of the more tropical outposts. The Age of Enlightenment was firmly founded on a drug-based economy. A remarkable process attended the introduction of tobacco into Europe. Because of the emphasis on the recreational potential and the large-scale planting of Nicotiana tobacum, the less toxic of the two major species, tobacco lost its connotation as a plant of shamanic and even hallucinogenic power. This was more than a matter of shifts in the standard dose and the method of administration. The native tobaccos that I have experienced among Amazonian peoples were extremely disorienting and barely subtoxic. They were definitely capable of producing an altered state of consciousness. The tobacco-using habit as it evolved in Europe was secular and recreational, and hence much more mild strains of tobacco were commercially successful. Once a drug is discovered, it often goes through a process of dilution before a general consensus is reached on the most desirable level of effect. Moving from eating opium or hashish to smoking of these substances was such a process, as was the move from large doses of LSD in the 1960s to the current practice of taking small doses of LSD for recreational reasons. This latter move may have been the consequence of the small but persistent percentage of people who suffered severe psychotic breaks after using large doses of LSD. The notion of the correct dose of a drug is something that a culture evolves over time. There are, of course, some counterexamples as well. The trend from snuffing powdered cocaine to smoking crack cocaine exemplifies a movement toward larger doses and more dangerous use patterns. The Opium Wars. It was the prohibition of tobacco smoking in China by the last emperor of the Ming Dynasty, 1628 to 1644, that led frustrated tobacco addicts to experiment with smoking opium. Before that time, the smoking of opium was not known. Thus it is that the suppression of one drug seems inevitably to lead to involvement with another. By 1793, opium and tobacco were being routinely smoked together throughout China. Beginning in 1729, the Chinese had strictly prohibited the importation and sale of opium. In spite of this, opium imports brought by the Portuguese from plantations in Goa continued to rise, until by 1830, more than 25,000 chests of opium were being illegally imported into China. English financial interests that felt threatened by the prohibitions manipulated the situation into the so-called Opium Wars of 1838 to 1842. The East India Company and the British government rationalized the opium trade with a kind of bland hypocrisy which has made the English establishment a byword for three centuries. There was no direct connection between the opium trade and the East India Company, which of course had a monopoly position in the British tea trade, until 1834. The opium was sold at auction in Calcutta. After this, the company abjured all responsibility for the drug. The incident that triggered this episode of capitalistic terrorism and true drug enslavement on a mass scale was the destruction of 20,000 chests of opium by Chinese authorities. In 1838, the Emperor Tao Kuang sent an official emissary named Lin to Canton to end the illegal trade in opium. Official orders were issued to the British and Chinese drug dealers to remove their goods, but the orders were ignored. Commissioner Lin then burned the Chinese warehouses on land and the British ships awaiting unloading in the harbor. More than a year's supply of opium was sent up in smoke. Chroniclers who witnessed the event recalled that the aroma was incomparable. The controversy dragged on, but eventually in 1840, war was declared. The British took the initiative, secure in the power and preeminence of the Royal Navy. The Chinese did not have a chance. The war was short and decisive. In 1840, Chusan was captured, and the following year the British bombarded and destroyed forts on the Canton River. The local Chinese commander, Qi Shen, who had succeeded Commissioner Lin, agreed to cede Hong Kong and pay an indemnity of 6 million Chinese silver dollars, worth about £300,000. When the news reached Peking, the emperor was left with no course but to agree. Thus, the Chinese suffered considerable losses in money and territory. 15 years later, a second war broke out. This war, too, ended unsuccessfully for China. Shortly afterward, the Treaty of Tientsin legalized the Chinese opium traffic. In many ways, this incident was to be the model for much larger forays into international drug trading on the part of 20th-century governments. It showed clearly that the potential marketability of new drugs can and will overwhelm institutional forces that oppose, or appear to oppose, the new commodity. The pattern established by England's 19th-century opium diplomacy has been repeated, albeit with some new wrinkles, in Central Intelligence Agency collusion in the international heroin and cocaine trade of our own time. Opium and cultural style. De Quincey. In the early 19th century, opium was influencing more than the Far Eastern policy of the mercantile empires. It was also having an unexpected influence on the aesthetic forms and styles of European thought. In a sense, European society was awakening from narcissistic preoccupation with Renaissance classicism and finding itself a spectator at the seductively metaphysical and aesthetically exotic banquet being conducted by the Grand Turk of the Ottomans. A banquet whose major aperitif was the opium vision. There is no way to avoid a discussion of Thomas De Quincey at this point. Like Timothy Leary in the 1960s, De Quincey was able to convey the visionary power of what he experienced. For De Quincey, this was a power imprisoned within the labyrinth of the poppy. He was able to convey the opium vision with the force and the filigree of melancholia typical of Romanticism. Almost single-handedly, he created in his Confessions of an English Opium Eater the cultural image, the zeitgeist of the experience of opium intoxication and a metaphysic of opium. He invented the form of the drug confession, the primary genre of subsequent drug literature. His descriptions of the worldview of the opium user are unsurpassed. Many years ago, when I was looking over Piranesi's Antiquities of Rome, Mr. Coleridge, who was standing by, described to me a set of plates by that artist, called his dreams, and which record the scenery of his own visions during the delirium of a fever. Some of them, I describe only from memory of Mr. Coleridge's account, represented vast Gothic halls, on the floor of which stood all sorts of engines and machinery, wheels, cables, pulleys, levers, catapults, etc., expressive of enormous power put forth, and resistance overcome. Creeping along the sides of the wall, you perceived a staircase, and upon it, groping his way upward, was Piranesi himself. Follow the stairs a little farther, and you perceive it to come to a sudden abrupt termination, without any balustrade, and allowing no step onward to him who had reached the extremity, except into the depths below. Whatever is to become of poor Piranesi, you suppose at least that his labors must in some way terminate here, But raise your eyes, and behold a second flight of stairs still higher, on which again Piranesi is perceived, but this time standing on the very brink of the abyss. Again elevate your eyes, and a still more aerial flight of stairs is beheld, and again is poor Piranesi busy on his aspiring labors. And so on until the unfinished stairs and Piranesi both are lost in the upper gloom of the hall. With the same power of endless growth and self-reproduction did my architecture proceed in dreams. Opium exhilarates the spirit. It can produce endlessly unraveling streamers of thought and rhapsodic speculation. The 50 years following De Quincey's Confessions were to see a deep grappling with the impact of opium use on creativity, especially literary creativity. De Quincey pioneered this effort. He was the first writer to study deliberately, from within his personal experience, the way in which dreams and visions are formed, how opium helps to form them and intensifies them, and how they are then recomposed and used in conscious art, in his case in impassioned prose. But the process would also apply to poetry. He learned his waking technique as a writer partly from observation of how the mind works in dreams and reveries under the influence of opium. It was his belief that opium dreams and reveries could be in themselves a creative process both analogous to and leading to literary creation. He used dreams in his writing not as a decoration, not as allegory, not as a device to create atmosphere or to forestall and help on the plot, not even as intimations of a higher reality, although he believed that they were that, but as a form of art in themselves. His study of the workings of the imagination in sleep to produce dreams was pursued with as much concentration as some of his contemporaries devoted to the working of the waking imagination to produce poetry. The beginning of psychopharmacology. The analytical and psychological interests of men like De Quincey and the French psychiatrist J.J. Moreau de Tours, and their attitudes toward the substances that they sought to explore, signify the beginnings of the less-than-happy effort of science to come to terms with these materials. Implicit in their work is the assumption that intoxication can mimic madness, a strong hint that madness, the most mental of maladies, was rooted in physical causes. The opium dream was seen as a kind of waking theater of the imagination, and there is in the fascination with dreams an anticipation of the psychoanalytical methods of Freud and Jung. This fascination is felt throughout the literature of the 19th century, in Goethe, in Baudelaire, in Mallarmé, Wiesmont, and Heine. It is the siren song of the unconscious, silent since the destruction of Eleusis, but expressed in Romanticism and the Pre-Raphaelites as a pagan exuberance, driven as often as not by devotion to opium. The heavy-lidded harlots of a Beardsley Seraglio, or the darker labyrinthine visions of Odilon Redon, or Dante Gabriel Rossetti, epitomize this aesthetic. As the aesthetic had a darker side, so too the chemistry of the poppy began to yield more consuming and more virulently addictive derivatives. The hypodermic syringe was discovered in 1853, and from then on the users of opiates have had the cautionary example of the severely addicted intravenous user of morphine to temper their devotion. The 19th century experienced a sorting out of the bewildering variety of new drugs and stimulants that the previous 2 centuries of exploration and exploitation of far-flung lands had brought. Tobacco use in its various forms became widespread in all social classes, especially among men. Opium was abused by smaller but nonetheless vast numbers of persons, also drawn from all classes. Distilled alcohol was produced and abused in far larger quantities than ever before. In this environment, temperance organizations also emerged, and the modern positions vis-à-vis the drug question began to develop. Yet the true impact of the spreading habits of synthetic drug abuse still lay ahead in the 20th century.